I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Hey, if you missed any part of this show, you can go to rofpodcast.com and become a member of our podcast. From there, you can listen to the latest show or listen to all of our archive shows. It's a great way to support independent media and never miss an episode of Ring of Fire Radio. Let's continue our discussion of this week's biggest news stories. Back to help me run down the biggest stories of the week, Heather Digby Parton from the blog Hullabaloo. So, Digby, in the last hour, we were talking about the Democratic response that we have seen so far, and granted, 5 or 6 days of real politics. And I was, you know, I think prior to Trump being sworn in, my feeling was that, you know, Democrats are still figuring out how they were going to approach this. And they're waiting till he's president because, you know, you can't push on a string, right? I mean, now there's actually some leverage points. Things are real now in the way they weren't, obviously, in the lame duck session. And yet, we're seeing stuff like two supposed fighting Democrats, progressive wing, sign off and vote for Ben Carson, you know, in what is largely a symbolic vote. Either way, we're trying to figure out what the net gain is, but the net loss seems to be quite obvious, doesn't it?
It's obvious to me. It just makes no sense to me at all. Here's for instance. We have a new administration and a new Congress that has, from the opening moments, shown that they have absolutely no interest in pursuing any kind of conflict of interest of either the president or any of his appointees. The corruption narrative around Donald Trump is exceedingly important. They are doing things no one has ever done before. This is an outrage. Last week, they were, you know, finally someone, I guess the moment that he got into office, they had it prepared, the lawsuit. They're attempting to sue him on the basis of violating the Constitution's emoluments clause, which is, you know, seems pretty reasonable to me since he is getting foreign money from God knows where, and we know for sure from his hotels. But you know, this is a theme. This is one of those narratives that needs to be pounded over and over again. So what does Donald Trump do? He sends to the Senate a group of nominees who have not been vetted, who did not produce the documents that they are required to produce. They have not been forthcoming about with the Secretary of State's refusing to give his tax returns across the board. Ben Carson, there were tremendous amount of questions about what he did with $65 million in his presidential campaign. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that in any past administration would have been, that every one of them would have been knocked out for what was happening. And so what do the Democrats do? They act like it's normal. It's not normal. And this was an easy gimme for them. This was an easy one. All they had to do was say, look, we're not going to do this. We're not voting for any of them. Across the board, as a group, we have decided, because of the way that the White House produced this group of candidates for the cabinet, we're just simply going to say no. This kind of corruption will not stand. That, you know, I mean, all these people have their good points and their bad points, we're sure, but no, we're not going to do it. And, you know, the base would have been thrilled by that. That's the kind of bold, you know, statement across the board that would have made headlines, that would have made people start looking at all these people, asking why all the Goldman Sachs people are in there, but putting the focus on this process that would have made the Democrats a real player, right? I mean, they're acting like they're potted plants as far as I'm concerned. They're just, you know, asking a few perfunctory questions and then moving on. I mean, they have to start thinking in these broader terms, in my mind. I mean, they're the professionals and all, but I this just really looks like a train wreck to me.
It looks like a train wreck to me, too. And I have to say, you know, this harkens back, Digby, to you know, conversations that you and I were probably having 10 years ago about, and certainly widespread online at the time, that Democrats need to learn to lose well.
Yes,
that they need to learn to gain things out of their losses. And they don't seem to understand this concept. And they don't seem to understand the value of losing in a way that is going to put down some flags and to plant some sort of milestones and saying, you know, we're not gonna cross this line here under any circumstances and for no reason, no how. And it really is stunning that to a certain extent, like, look, I don't know if this is a problem with Chuck Schumer, but somebody has got to step up in that Senate and provide some leadership. You know, Kirsten Gillibrand came close to being the only person who voted against all the nominees. She ended up voting for Nikki Haley, which I guess presumably was her, you know, trying to look reasonable. But I'm just curious as to, you know, who is it they think is going to hold them to account? I mean, how many voters are going to say to Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, hey, you didn't vote for Nikki Haley for ambassador, or even, you know, even, you know, the I don't know, the Chuck Todds or the John Dickersons. I mean, whatever they perceive as the sort of establishment media is going to in some way make them pay a price. I mean, it's very hard to imagine someone arguing, like, how could someone not vote for Ben Carson? I mean, Ben Carson took himself out of the running because he wasn't qualified for these things.
He said it.
it really is stunning. And I guess the question is, Digby, you know, and we will get into some of the signing statements and executive orders in the next segment. But what's it going to take? I mean, I know there are people out there saying, you know, how can I get my, you know, my Democratic supposed leaders to react well? And is it simply call them?
Well, I mean, I know that is something that you know, people say does have an effect. Writing letters to the editor of the local papers. I mean, actual letters, you know, actually does have an effect. These people are concerned with, you know, how their local, especially their local constituents are seeing them. You know, and there are a number of groups that are forming out there that are talking about this, how to sort of, you know, get a local collective kind of resistance going. And, you know, I think that's probably really valuable. I mean, you know, you have to look at the Tea Party, for instance, on the right, that came together through both grassroots and big money contributors who helped do that. I don't know if there's any big money coming into the Democratic side, but, you know, there are ways to do this kind of stuff. But, you know, we do have to depend on our representatives. I mean, the Republicans in Congress didn't have any problem opposing absolutely everything that Barack Obama tried to do. And that was a big part of what fueled that resistance on the part of the right. And the Democrats, instead of, you know, listening to some centrist think tank telling them they need to be reasonable and preserve norms or whatever it is they think they're doing, maybe they need to take a look at how the right did it, because they won big in 2010.
Maybe they should just, you know, ask the news outlets for footage of last week's march.
Yeah.
I mean, that seemed to really not resonate with them very well. But all right, let's take a break and let's dig into some of the executive orders from this past week and what we're hearing about what's going to happen in the future to things like our health care, our Social Security. We've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Sam Seder on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm talking to Heather Parton, the great Digby. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, here with Digby, and we're running through some of the biggest news stories of the week. So, Digby, one of the more disturbing things of the past week, and there's been plenty, was the freeze. And I feel like this is unprecedented, at least in my memory. The freeze that the Trump administration imposed on many agencies throughout our government, a freeze on their ability not just to make announcements to the public, but to anybody outside of the agency. Has this happened before, and what are the implications of it?
I haven't seen any evidence that it's happened before. I mean, maybe it has, or maybe on some sort of ad hoc basis while they were shifting, you know, to a new regime or something. They said, hey, everybody, you know, put things on hold. But this seems to be an across-the-board directive that they can no longer, that these agencies can no longer, that this essentially function. I mean, they're talking about no longer allowing, say, the Department of Commerce to give out information their press offices, information that's designed to help exporters, for instance, just some, you know, group of statistics that they might normally use to, you know, provide information to companies in the country. They're no longer allowed to do that. And I'm not even talking about the big stuff like climate change, crime statistics, the sort of things that we as liberals would be concerned with. I'm just talking about everyday business that the government is doing. They are stopping that, and basically putting the federal government under a gag order. And you know, nobody really understands what's happening. Sean Spicer, the press secretary, is very vague about what this is. Now, oh no, it is, but it isn't, and don't worry, and you know, that was local, and this is federal, and you know, he has not been clear about what this is. And of course, the whole point of it is to establish a chill within the federal government of anyone saying anything that, you know, it's a Big Brother move, right? We're watching you. We know what you're doing. And in fact, there was a case where the Forest Service? One of the agencies put out some statistics that were, was it about the
Badlands, National Park.
Right. Yeah, about Badlands National Park, and they were shut down. Now, the administration says that was a rogue employee who, you know, hacked into the account or whatever. But, you know, the fact that this, these tweets were taken down and deleted and, you know, that was happening at the same time we're getting these directives. So, I mean, this is a chill. What they're saying is, look, we're watching you. We are going to question anything that you do that sounds like it goes against our, you know, overarching philosophy here, which, by the way, you know, we don't actually know, but we know that everybody's going to now be very, very reluctant. And in fact, here's the shocking thing is that on inauguration day, scientists got together, climate scientists, and downloaded vast amount of information to European servers that they had.
Because they were afraid that this stuff would be basically jettisoned.
And, that's right.
And you know, I think it actually, what they're doing even goes even further, right? Because we're talking about the Department of Interior, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Agriculture, Health and Human Services, you know, the USDA, research facilities, the EPA. Not only is it like, you know, a gag order and create this chilling effect, and like you say, though, but from an operational standpoint, many of these agencies have outside contractors that may do meat inspections, that may do doing data research, that may be testing the water quality in certain areas. And they can't even talk to these people. So what it begins to do is it starts to corrode the infrastructure of these agencies. Because if you are an architectural build design firm, and you've been hired by the Department of the Interior to build X, Y, or Z, and you're out of communication and you can't talk to them, You just have employees that are just sitting around doing nothing, and that's not sustainable long term.
Right.
You have situations where this week the Michigan Environmental Protection Agency announced that Flint's water was no longer at levels that were unacceptable amounts of lead relative to the EPA, national EPA's guidelines. But we have no way of knowing if that is an improvement in the water or simply a degradation of the EPA's standards
right.
on what constitutes healthy water in terms of lead, because the EPA cannot announce that and is no longer allowed, never mind obligated, no longer allowed to announce as to whether or not their standards have been loosened. So we have no way of knowing if there's actually a diminishment of lead in that water in Flint, or it's simply that the standards have been relaxed and the water's okay now. I mean, this is so far reaching. And I think the other element of it is that what it does is it completely demoralizes everybody working there, because
Absolutely.
The thing an administration like this wants to do is to get rid of the civil servants as quickly and as efficiently as possible. Because they want to stack these things, you know, because people at the EPA, they're at the EPA because they want to protect the environment. Yeah. That's why a normal person goes to the Environmental Protection Agency. The appointees, the political appointees, their one desire to go to the EPA is to roll back protections for the environment, and they need to have as few people dedicated to protecting the environment as possible at these agencies. And I would go right down the line with whether it's protecting the quality of our food and on and on. But all right, we've got more to talk about, but we're going to have to save it for the next hour. I'm talking to Heather Parton, the great Digby. I'm Sam Seder. We'll be back with more after this. Just ahead, NRDC's Anthony Swift on executive orders that will revive the Keystone and Dakota Access pipelines while ignoring some important environmental concerns. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
She'll lie and steal and cheat and beg you from her knees, make you think she needs it this time. She'll tear a hole in you, the one you can't repair.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. This week, Donald Trump signed off on some important environmental policy changes. These policies include steps to limit the role that climate change plays in government decisions and speed the review of cross-border pipelines such as Keystone XL and the Dakota Access Pipeline. Here to discuss these policies, Anthony Swift, Director of the Canada Project for the NRDC. So, Anthony, among the many executive orders that President Trump has signed over the past week or so, I guess now. It feels like it's been years, frankly. I guess it was just earlier this week, involved the Trans-Canadian Keystone XL pipeline and also the Dakota Access pipelines. I mean, I think people are familiar with, obviously, with both. But tell us what the executive order means. Because my understanding, at least with Keystone, is, right, that at the very least, you need to go through the State Department. I mean, I know that might be pro forma under a Trump administration, but tell us what these executive orders mean.
Well, it's a really good question, because these executive orders don't go so far as, I mean, in the case of Keystone, to approve the pipeline. But what they both do is they set up a very expedited process that makes it very hard to have anything other than a rubber stamp approval for both Keystone XL and the Dakota Access Pipeline. In the case of Keystone XL, as a first step, President Trump is inviting Keystone XL to reapply, or inviting TransCanada to reapply for the Keystone XL pipeline. And that in itself is a problem, because when President Obama rejected Keystone XL, it was really as a part of a rigorous process that had that was transparent and had significant public input. And what Trump is doing is basically ignoring the outcome of that process and creating this 60-day approval window, and requiring the State Department to rely on a environmental impact statement that's more than 3 years old at this point. And there have been many new developments that are of material importance for Keystone XL. I mean, one being that with oil prices falling through the floor, the argument that we need such a pipeline, or that there's actually production to fill it, is much weaker. And there have been recent studies that show that tar sand spills are far more devastating than we thought at the time when the State Department was reviewing the pipeline, a study from the National Academy of Sciences.
It's simply an invitation for a reapplication by TransCanada, and then it outlines a new framework. Basically, you know, we have the old, framework for how the decision was going to be made. It outlines a new framework, one which you're saying now is basically just a 60-day turnaround, and it okays the use of the environmental impact report from years ago. I mean, that's what it's outlining.
That's exactly right. It, you know, the three things are: it invites TransCanada to reapply, it gives a 60-day deadline for a decision, and it requires that decision to use a three-year environmental assessment in as much as possible by law. And that's an interesting question, because in reality, you know, our environmental rules and regulations, there are reasons why, I mean, there are prohibitions from using outdated information and ignoring major new developments. But the problem here is that it's unlikely that the State Department could update that environmental review within 60 days, and certainly not in a transparent manner. So what we're left with is basically an invitation to reapply and a 60-day decision based on outdated information.
And we should remind people that the reason why the State Department is in the position of okaying it is because this is a pipeline which crosses a national border with Canada. So let me ask you this. Why did Trump even have to reinitiate the State Department process? Why couldn't he just say that they just sign off? Or does the president not have that ability?
Well, he could have, and that's, you know, to tell you the truth, your guess is as good as mine. I think that Trump very well could have said, we will approve any application that comes in advance, and we don't know exactly why he left even the resemblance, or why he even left a rubber stamp approval process. But that being said, there may have been concerns that if they didn't have at least some sort of process, even a rubber stamp process, it would make the pipeline decision more vulnerable to litigation after the fact. But, you know, as a broader point, it's worth noting that the national interest determination process, the process that Trump is really changing and expediting under for Keystone XL, has been in place in various forms, I mean, in the current form, really, since Lyndon B. Johnson, and has been used by presidents of both parties to evaluate cross-border applications for infrastructure and make sure that we're not moving forward with infrastructure projects that aren't in our nation's interest. And this move really undermines that process.
And before we talk about the Dakota Access Pipeline, which was also signed, I guess, simultaneously, what is the interest that TransCanada has at this point in Keystone XL? Because I asked this question because you mentioned that, the environmental impact report has changed because of and not just the environmental import, not just the impact side of that ledger, but the value of the project side of the ledger has changed because of changes in the cost of oil. My understanding is that we are still at a situation where the cost of oil is such that it is not economically viable for TransCanada to pull this very dirty oil product, really, is what it is, out of the ground, because the cost in transporting it even through a pipeline and the cost in refining it because of the nature of the product, it's not technically oil-ish, it's more sludgy, is such that it's not, TransCanada might have less interest in it going forward. Is that the case?
You know, that is the $8 billion question, because as you said, the world has changed dramatically since 2008 when the project was first proposed. You know, one of the TransCanada was counting on oil prices in excess of $100 a barrel. And the State Department Environmental Review also assumed that oil prices would be over $100 a barrel during Keystone XL's existence. And why that's important is, as you say, tar sands oil is not what people think of when they think of oil. It's this very thick, low-grade sludge that is not only environmentally damaging, incredibly environmentally damaging to get out of the ground, but expensive to do it. It's some of the most expensive oil to produce. And with oil prices in the $50 a barrel range, the reality is there's not a lot of appetite for expanding some of the most expensive and environmentally damaging oil sources in the world. We've seen, you know, while some tar sands projects that had been under construction and had a lot of money put into them have continued along that pathway in recent years, we haven't seen a single tar sands production project approved for construction since 2014, and that's just a dramatic difference in picture from when the Keystone debate was really at its height. So the irony here is, you know, Trump is approving a pipeline that really has a place in the past, because we really need a complete lack of climate policies globally, and we need much, much higher oil prices for Keystone XL to make any economic sense. And we don't have that.
And of course, I mean, this is obviously largely a sort of almost a box that you check off with when you talk about conservative political identity, when a lot of people don't really understand the implications of it anyways. I mean, this is not oil that we're going to see anyways. It's just going to be sold off. We're just basically, this is a sort of a fly-by-night operation as far as the continental U.S. is concerned. All right, we need to take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about the Dakota Access Pipeline. I also want to touch on Scott Pruitt, who we anticipate will get will be vote on this coming week. He, of course, is the nominee to the EPA. I'm talking to Anthony Swift from the Natural Resource Defense Council. We'll be right back. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire.
I had a dream about a burning house. You were stuck inside. I couldn't get you out. Laid beside you and pulled you close, and the two of us went up in smoke.
back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with the director of the Canada Project, Anthony Swift. Anthony, when we broke, we were talking about the Keystone XL, the President Trump's executive order, basically inviting TransCanada to reapply, outlining what a new process would look like. It is obviously not a terribly rigorous one. What did he sign in regards to the Dakota Access Pipeline?
Well, with regard to the Dakota Access Pipeline, he signed an order that instructed the Corps of Engineers to approve any permits before it. And again, it was a process to ensure that the environmental review of those water crossing permits did not stop the pipeline. And that matters because, you know, I think one of the reasons there was so much opposition to that project is we really have a poor process for evaluating these large pipeline projects domestically with very limited public review. And, you know, the Standing Rock tribe, as well as other First Nations tribes, were incredibly concerned about the impact of this particular pipeline to their water sources, you know, along the river crossings, and to the ceremonial sites in their territorial lands.
And so this basically just says expedite everything, let it go.
That's right.
So in many respects, the signature of the Dakota Access Pipeline, far more dangerous, or I should say a far greater immediate threat than the Keystone XL pipeline signature.
This is true because we have a pipeline that is partially built and a company that has been incredibly aggressive in its attempts to move it along. And, of course, there is a very resolute group of people that are that do not want to see it move through their lands. And frankly, you know, one of the concerns that they had was the impact of oil spills in the Missouri River on the crossing. And, you know, we recently, in December, saw a major oil spill just a few hours away from that region where a pipeline spilled about 176,000 gallons. And the spill went, you know, about 7 miles down the river into creeks before it was found. So the idea that oil spills from these pipeline projects are just once-in-a-lifetime situations is really false. Every year we have about 400 pipeline incidents in the U.S. So these pipelines do spill, and that's why we have to be very careful where they go and have to evaluate whether it makes sense to build them.
So what is it that people can do, particularly to fight the Dakota Access Pipeline at this point? I mean, what... ultimately, the project was stalled because of massive protests, obviously, that were responded to by the Obama administration. What kind of steps can people take now, and you know, where's the leverage point?
There's little question that the Standing Rock tribe has been the center of opposition to that project, and you know, in a process that makes sense, we would have government-to-government discussions between the U.S. government and the Standing Rock Sioux. Now, whether that is actually going to happen in a Trump administration is quite in doubt, and I think that, you know, in many cases we have the same levers that we had before, which is, you know, public opposition and engagement with the Corps of Engineers and the Trump administration, but there is little question that we're in a rough spot where we have an administration that is trying to push through projects despite dramatic public opposition and using processes that are untransparent and, you know, not fact-based.
So let's turn to, aside from those two measures, the other major, I guess, impact that we're going to see, at least in the short term, by the Trump administration on the environment is their nomination, yet to be voted upon, of Scott Pruitt, the former Oklahoma Attorney General, to head the Environmental protection agency, and I make a point of saying the name of the organization out loud because Scott Pruitt has articulated zero interest in expanding the protection of the environment. His entire agenda seems to be, how can we mitigate protection of the environment to help business? And they don't seem to make any bones against that.
Yeah, it is unquestionably a to say alarming in regard to Scott Pruitt's nomination is an understatement. I mean, this is a person who has built his career on systematically attacking the EPA's authority to deal with rising carbon emissions, to ensure safe drinking water, to ensure clean air, and all of these areas where EPA has been a critical voice in ensuring that public health and the environment is protected, he has been on the wrong side of every single issue.
And so what what do you think? Are there any chances? Are there any Republican committee members that may vote against this guy?
Well, there is a little question that NRDC is staunchly opposed to Scott Pruitt, and we are prevailing upon, of course, Democrats who care about these issues, but also Republicans. I think that clean air, clean water, and a safe climate are all issues that should cross party lines, and certainly, Americans across the country care about these issues. So, I think that we are prevailing upon moderate folks on both sides of the aisle to oppose Scott Pruitt. But in terms of how it will pan out, we will just have to see.
And we will get a better notion of that in the days to come. Of course, Scott Pruitt's one of his co-chairs on his 2014 reelection committee, Harold Hamm, a major fracking oil executive. I mean, this is it is pretty clear whose interest Scott Pruitt represents when he attempts to lead the Environmental Protection Agency. Anthony, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sam.
Anthony Swift is the director of the Canada Project. You can learn more at nrdc.org. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will be back to run down more news of the week. And if you missed any part of this show, go to rofpodcast.com and become a member. You'll get the full show without commercials, and you'll keep this program on the air. You can keep up with us on social media by following us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and subscribing to our YouTube channel. To do so, just go to ringoffireradio.com for more info.
I'm Mike Papantonio, and you've been listening to a free sample of Ring of Fire Radio. If you'd like to listen to the full show, subscribe to our weekly podcast at our website at ringoffireradio.com. It's your support that helps keep us on the air.